Friend or Foe by Howard Jones.
They're here.
Okay, be down in a tick.
I'll go and give them a hand with the luggage. Bill, Annie, great to see you. How was the journey?
Oh, fine. We came down the A49 rather than the motorway. Can't stand all that congestion around Birmingham. Stopped for a coffee at Market Drayton overlooking the canal. Oh, very restful. Makes me fancy a canal boat holiday.
Yes, we did one about 20 years ago. Four counties ring. Just over 100 miles and 100 locks. Wouldn't like to do it now without some younger help. Here, Bill, let me give you a hand with the bags. Sue's just coming.
Sorry, I was upstairs finishing off your room.
Probably just making sure she'd folded the end of the loo roll into a triangle.
Oh, it's these little touches that count. Anyway, come on through. I'll make some tea, unless you prefer coffee.
Oh, no, tea's fine for me.
Oh, yes, tea would be lovely.
Let's go through to the conservatory. Or should I call it the orangery or sunroom nowadays? Must keep up with the trendsetters.
How are you both?
Fine. Apart from the odd ache and pain. I'll go and make the tea.
Know what you mean? You wake up with a little niggle one day, that goes and is replaced by another the next day. Old age, I'm afraid.
Well, you seem to have the right genes, Bob. Judging by your mother, anyway. How has she settled into her new place?
Fine. The good thing is that she can summon help when she needs it, but still has her independence. I just hope I'm as good if I get to 101.
I must say that you're both looking well. Must be that nomadic life you lead in that motorhome of yours. Where was it this year?
Oh, a few places in this country. But our main trip was to Germany, Bavaria mostly.
Oh, sounds great. You must tell us all about it.
Are you sure? Nothing worse than sitting through other people's holiday photos and stories.
Well, you've ploughed through enough of our pantomime shots. Which reminds me, I'm still waiting for Bill to run this year's off the computer.
Never mind. Some day your prince will come.
Oh, yes.
What did you do this year?
Jack and the Beanstalk. I was Jack's mother and Bill was a rear end of the cow.
Yes, that's a fair reflection of our respective acting talents.
Here we are. Just give it a minute to brew.
Yes, Bill has many good points, but sometimes he just needs a little prod to do things now and again.
Well, no husband is perfect. Bob is still a work in progress after 42 years of effort. It's taking longer to finish than the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona.
You know, I think women think finding a husband is like looking for a house. They start off with an ideal, then eventually decide it doesn't exist, settle for the next best thing, and then set out to make improvements. I'm only relieved she's never asked me to consider an extension.
Oh, Bill's not too bad, really. I think that after 40-odd years, I've worked out how to handle him.
Yes, all I need now is for her to put it into practice.
So, tell us about this holiday of yours. How did you find the driving?
It was okay. Well, as you know, I've driven a fair bit on the continent, but not recently. The thing is, there's so much more room. Our motorways and roads are so congested. Mind you, some of them in Germany really shift where it's allowed. Just as well they make low-emission cars with the fuel that they burn up. No, with a motorhome, you just tuck yourself into the right-hand lane and all you need to do is watch out for traffic joining the motorway.
I think the Germans feel that they have a hereditary right to drive cars fast, a bit like the Americans feel about owning guns. They seem to have contradictory ideas regarding the environment. Using all that fuel in cars, but you're not allowed to wash your car at home to avoid polluting the drainage system. The other thing we noticed was cigarette machines in the street. There certainly seem to be more people smoking over there.
So, where did you start?
Rüdesheim, on the Rhine. Campsite's right next to the river. The cruise ships were moored right in front of us. It's just at the point where the river widens out, after passing through a narrower part, which is the World Heritage Site. lined with vineyards and the odd Gothic castle up on the hills. Bit of a tourist town, but a good base.
You can take a river trip up to the Lorelei. Not that it's anything special in my view, just a large slate rock. It's one of those legends that draws tourists, a bit like the Loch Ness Monster.
Wasn't the story that a maiden with long blonde hair lured sailors to their doom?
Yes, I've met a few like that in my time. The weather was great, so we really enjoyed it. It was one of those days when it was almost worth being alive. Another thing you could do is to take a cable car from the town up to Germania, which I'd never heard of, but it's apparently famous.
Can't say I know it either. Come on, spill the beans.
It's a large monument, typically German and martial. Started as a celebration of the Prussian victory in the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, but came to symbolise the unification of the various states into one country in the 1870s.
I didn't realise that it was only then that Germany was formed. Some countries seem to be going the other way. Spain with Catalonia. Even this country with Scotland possibly going its own way. Although that seems less likely.
When you think about it, most countries only settle their current borders relatively recently. Usually in the aftermath of wars. Even this country only took its present form in 1922... when the Irish Republic was formed. Makes you wonder about the EU's chances of forming one state out of the remaining 27. But don't let's go into that.
We also found out a bit about the German national anthem, Deutschland über alles, Germany above all. I always thought it meant Germany above all other countries, as the Nazis used it, but it really meant a united Germany over its previous individual parts. They only sing the third verse now because of its previous connotations.
The other thing we discovered was the remains of the Hindenburg Bridge. We went for a stroll from the campsite and came across some huge chunks of concrete and brickwork, which were obviously part of a bridge. There was a sign attached to it which said it was the Hindenburg Bridge, blown up by the German army in 1945 to slow the American advance across the Rhine. I looked it up on the internet. It was a 1,000-metre-long railway bridge, named after Paul von Hindenburg, you know, the chief of the German army in the First War. He was president before Hitler came to power and actually appointed Hitler as chancellor. He didn't have a majority in the Reichstag.
His name seems to have been associated with a lot of failures. Chief of a defeated army, appointing Hitler, a bridge blown up, and the airship that crashed. The Nick Clegg of his time.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, isn't it? It's impossible to talk about Germany for very long before mentioning the war, as Basil Fawlty would say. We were all born just as the war ended, but we still talk about it before and after the war, although it finished nearly 73 years ago. I suppose eventually the younger generations will see it as part of history.
I guess so. It's understandable whilst there are still those who fought in it alive or were children who were either evacuated or spent their nights being terrified in an air raid shelter, it'll remain the most significant event in their lives. I think it's also important that we remember what can happen to even civilised countries if the wrong people get power.
So where did you go after the Rudesheim?
It was a tour down the Romantic Road, as it was known, starts at Würzburg and finishes at Fussen, near Neuschwanstein Castle. You know, the famous one on the hill used in films, mostly by Disney. You call at various towns. Rottenburg ob der Tauber is probably best known. Well, you've heard about the Christmas shop, have you?
Is that the one that's open all year?
Yes. A woman called Kathy Wolfhart had an idea back in the 1970s to have an all-year-round Christmas shop and museum. Everyone thought that she was mad, but it's been a great success. Draws visitors from all around the world, especially the Far East. Very tasteful, but very expensive. Mostly wooden decorations. Even Bob took an interest. He usually goes into a semi-coma in shops. He says that he would rather have root canal treatment without anaesthetic than shop.
The nice thing about Rothenburg is they don't allow neon signs, so all the shops have old-fashioned signs. And there are no McDonald's or Starbucks, etc. Well, at least in the town centre. Food speciality is a schneeball or snowball. It's pastry deep-fried and covered in chocolate, about the size of a tennis ball. Bit heavy for my taste, but very popular.
Rothenburg was bombed and part of the town walls and some buildings were damaged, but the Americans held off an artillery bombardment because of its historical importance. They sent 6 soldiers into the town to negotiate its surrender, which the senior German officer agreed to, ignoring Hitler's orders to defend all towns.
Sounds an interesting place, Bill. We must put it on the bucket list. So, where did you go next?
Various places. Dinkelspiel, Donauwörth, very picturesque. Lots of buildings in various pastel colours. I don't know if there are rules governing which colour you can use, but each house is different. You can walk right around Donauwörth along the walls. As the name suggests, the Danube runs through it. After that, Augsburg, which is quite a large city. Campsite was a bit out of town, near the airport.
Yeah, that's a coincidence. I've just read a book about Rudolf Hess. It seems that he took off from Augsburg when he flew to Scotland in 1941. It was a centre of production and development for Messerschmitts. He had one specially adapted with extra fuel tanks to be able to reach Scotland, which was beyond the normal range of Messerschmitts 110. It's an interesting book, written by Peter Lovesey. Have you read any of his stuff?
Yes, I think so. Doesn't he write about a detective in Bath?
Yes, Peter Diamond. It's a fascinating story. After interrogation, he spent most of his time just down the road near Abergavenny at Maindrift Court until he was taken to Nuremberg for the war trials. He claimed that he was suffering from amnesia. Anyway, he received a jail sentence rather than an execution, like the other top Nazis.
So why did he fly to Scotland?
Well, his story was that he wanted to see the Duke of Hamilton, who he wrongly believed would be part of a powerful group who would lobby Churchill to make peace with Germany. He flew here just before Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union. He was privy to the plans and wanted to avoid a second front. Remember that certain members of the British aristocracy were sympathetic to Hitler, and saw the communists as a greater threat to their wealth and privilege. Anyway, he bailed out and damaged his ankle. He was captured by a local farmer and handed over to the authorities. There's some debate about whether he was acting alone or sent by Hitler. I don't suppose that we will ever know. If you remember, he was kept in Spandau prison as the only prisoner until he committed suicide in 1993. The Russians always objected to his release. So, what's in the Augsburg to see?
Well, the Golden Hall in the Rathaus is amazing. Incredible reconstruction. Augsburg was an important town for production of airplane and submarine engines, so it was very heavily bombed in 1944. It's been rebuilt in traditional style, but the reconstruction of the Golden Hall is a sight to behold. Cost a fortune. It's worth looking it up on the internet.
Then we went to the Fuggerei, which we'd never heard of, but is the oldest social housing complex in the world. People have been living there since 1523. The Fugger family were wealthy traders, but also philanthropists, and one of the things they did was to build the Fuggerei, which consists of several rows of terraced houses for needy people. They're a deep yellow colour and covered in ivy and Virginia creeper. Mozart's great-grandfather lived there. The annual rent is less than €1.
You can visit one of the properties. It's kept as a museum. It was previously occupied by an old chap who died, but they kept it as an example of the way things were before the modernisation they're doing. When I was in there, I noticed an old photograph of 2 football teams, dating from the 1930s. I didn't think any more about it at the time, but as I'll tell you in a bit, it became a great personal interest.
After Augsburg, the next stop was Schwangau to visit Neuschwanstein Castle, built by King Ludwig in the 1880s. You must have seen lots of pictures of it up on the hill. It was used in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Actually, it's much more impressive from the outside. Sadly, he died before it was finished, so only some of the rooms were complete. He was a great admirer of Wagner, so all the rooms are painted with scenes from his operas.
I've read a bit about Ludwig. He was a strange character by all accounts. Very introverted and disliked the official business of being king. He came to the throne when he was 18 and died when he was only 40 in mysterious circumstances.
Yes, he was arrested by his ministers at Neuschwanstein and taken to a castle near Munich. They put together a dossier purporting to show that he was mentally unfit to be king and signed by doctors who had not examined him. He and a Dr. Gooden went for a walk in the grounds one evening and did not return. Their bodies were found in shallow water, and the autopsy gave the cause of death as drowning, although there was no water in his lungs. The doctor's body showed some signs of strangulation. Ludwig's personal fisherman was sworn to secrecy, but left notes after his death saying that he was hiding near the spot, ready to help Ludwig escape by boat. But as he stepped onto the boat, a shot rang out and the king fell dead onto the boat. The official autopsy made no mention of wounds. Many years later, a countess would show her guests a coat with bullet holes in it, saying that it was the coat he was wearing. Another theory was that he died of a heart attack from the cold water.
He was probably just eccentric. It's been suggested that he was a homosexual, which was not actually punishable in Bavaria after 1813. But it changed after German unification when Prussia dominated. He was engaged at one time, but broke it off after postponing the wedding several times. Anyway, he left a legacy for which the Bavarian tourist industry is grateful. Apparently about 1.3 million people visit every year. He paid for its construction out of his own pocket, and by borrowing rather than using state funds.
Sounds a good trip. So, what happened to the Fuggerei, which was a personal interest?
Well, when we came home, we started to sort some stuff from my mother's house, including some photographs and scrapbooks, which included some old newspaper cuttings from the Bransfield News. As you know, my father played for the town before the war, so he was in the papers quite a lot. I came across a photograph taken in 1936 and recognised it as the same one I'd seen in the Fuggerei. The caption underneath said it was taken during the recent visit to Bavaria by the Bransfield Town youth team, following their match against the local Augsburg team, and a return visit was planned for the following year. I wondered whether my father Jim and the old chap who had lived in the Fuggerei had actually played against each other.
Quite a coincidence if they did.
I asked my mother if she knew any more. She wasn't sure because she only just met my father about the time he went to Germany. But she remembered him talking about the family he stayed with and thought he'd mentioned the name Werner. That wasn't the end of it. Apart from the houses at the Fuggerei, there was a museum situated in what had been an air raid shelter during the war. There was a feature including a photograph of a man in uniform next to one of him in football kit. Oh, my German isn't that good, but with the aid of a dictionary and a bit of internet research, I worked out that it was the man whose house we had visited and was now the museum. His name was Werner Schmidt, and it seems that he played top-level football before and during the war in Bavaria. But Germany didn't have a national football league until 1963. It was all on a regional basis.
Well, when our league started in 1888, it was not national. All the teams were in the North and Midlands. Arsenal were the first southern-based, and that was in, 5 years after the league started.
It appears he was saved from being sent to the front by playing football. Instead, he was on an anti-aircraft battery defending Augsburg. He was injured during the huge raid on Augsburg in May 1944 and was unable to play top-level football again.
So it's possible that your father and Werner Schmidt not only played against each other, But that he stayed with his family.
Quite likely, I'd have thought. Well, they were both born in 1916 and would have been youth players in 1936 when Bransfield visited Bavaria. I came across something else in the scrapbooks which raised the chance of a much more serious connection between my father and Werner Schmidt.
Sounds intriguing.
I think I've mentioned in the past that he was in the RAF and flew in Lancasters as a bomb aimer. But I didn't know the detail of his missions, except that his plane had been damaged in a raid and had crash-landed on return to base. He broke both legs and that was the end of his football career. Like a lot of them, he was reluctant to talk about his war service. Perhaps it was too emotional for him, remembering his lost colleagues. I think he also felt a bit resentful about the criticism in some quarters of Bomber Command for blanket bombing of cities, even those of non-strategic importance, like Dresden. In any event, Augsburg was very much a legitimate target as a centre of aircraft and U-boat engine production. I do remember him telling me that apart from anti-aircraft fire, night fighters were the biggest threat to the bombers, so the planes flew very low before reaching the target. His role was to warn the pilot of approaching power lines, church steeples, etc. He also picked out landmarks, rivers, railway lines, etc. to help the navigator, who strangely could not see outside from his seat in the Lancaster.
So, you think he could have been involved in the Augsburg raid?
Well, it would have been a long shot without some sort of evidence. As I mentioned, I was going through some old scrapbooks that my mother had kept, mostly about my father's football career and some about my grandfather, George Roberts, who played for the town before the First War. There was also a cutting about the Augsburg raid. I've downloaded it to my iPad from the newspaper archive. I'll just read a bit to you. Right, here it is. RAF pour 1,700 tons on Augsburg. Augsburg, the great German aircraft manufacturing and engineering centre, 30 miles northwest of Munich, was devastated on Friday night by RAF heavy bombers. A total of 1,700 tons was dropped. Our bombers went over a few hours after US heavies had attacked in daylight. Large forces of Lancasters and Halifaxes took part. They repeated the tactics used at Schweinfurt the previous night by making two separate attacks. Visibility was excellent and little fighter opposition was met. Soon large fires were started. In the 2.5 hours between the attacks, the firefighters were unable to get the fires under control. Crews of the second force were able to see the fires long before reaching Augsburg, and their own bombing spread the conflagration until it extended over most of the target area. The pilot of one Halifax said, "We were over the town for 6 minutes and had an excellent view of the attack. There were tremendous red fires below." Of the large number of planes involved, 24 were lost, including one that came down in Switzerland. The crew bailed out.
Presumably your mother would not have cut it out if your father was not involved.
Well, I asked her about it and said that he was involved, but his plane crash-landed on return and he was injured. She said there should be another cutting somewhere about his injuries. She felt glad in a way that he'd been injured, as it probably saved his life, given the very high casualty rate in Bomber Command. Sure enough, I found the cutting. It said that Jim Gibson, the well-known Bransfield footballer, had been injured whilst on active service for the RAF, and whilst his injuries were not life-threatening, he was unlikely to play professional football again.
So the two footballers had been injured during the same raid?
Yes. I wondered what the chances were that my father's plane had dropped the bomb that injured Werner Schmidt, and whether his anti-aircraft gun had fired the shell that damaged my father's plane. The odds against that were very high, as there were hundreds of planes involved, and the city was heavily defended by a ring of anti-aircraft guns.
Nevertheless, they did directly oppose each other, both at football and during the war.
Incidentally, I discovered on the internet that Augsburg had been bombed in 1942 in a disastrous daylight raid in which 7 of the 12 planes were lost, together with 49 of the crew out of 84. That was the raid that Squadron Leader Nettleton won the Victoria Cross. for getting to the target with one other plane and accurately dropping his bombs. The other plane was shot down over the target. Sadly, he was killed returning from a raid on Turin the following year.
I wonder what would have happened had your father and Werner Schmidt met after the war. Would they have met as friends as they had been in 1936, or as foes as in 1944?
I remember reading a biography of Douglas Bader. He became friends with Adolf Galland, the German fighter pilot after the war, despite opposing each other during the Battle of Britain. I suppose it was out of a sort of mutual respect. There are also cases of German and Italian prisoners of war staying in this country and marrying local girls.
Remember Bert Troutman? Played in goal for Manchester City for a long time. About 15 years, I think.
Wasn't he the one who broke his neck in the cup final?
That's right, against Birmingham. Stayed on the pitch and helped them win the cup. 1956. Was voted Footballer of the Year. Mind you, there was some opposition to him playing so soon after the war, and the fact he was replacing the legendary Frank Swift. The club captain, Eric Westwood, who had fought in Normandy, had reservations about the signing, but publicly welcomed Troutman by saying, "There is no war in the dressing room." I'd like to think that if they had met, they would have done so amicably. They were both victims of circumstances created by others. Well, I think the sun's over the yard arm. Time for an aperitif. Anne, Sue, G&T?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Bill?
Yeah.
Oh, whiskey fine. And dry ginger? Yeah.
Please. Yes.
Tell them the rest of the story.
After discovering the possible link between my father and Werner Schmidt, I emailed the Fuggerier, asking whether they were aware of any living close relatives of Werner, and if so, could I have contact details? They replied saying that they couldn't do that because of data protection, but they would pass on my email to Michael Schmidt, who is Werner's son. Sure enough, a few days later, I received an email from him. He's about the same age as us and living in retirement near Augsburg.
And the exciting bit is that he plans to come to the UK later this year. So we've invited him to visit if he's in the area.
So the family friendship, which began in 1936 and was interrupted by war, might be continued in 2018. Sadly, not by Jim and Werner, but their sons. I think that would be great.
Yes, it would. There we are. Cheers. And here's to friendship.
Cheers.
And to Jim and Werner.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
This is a Bare Bones Theatre production with the following cast. Bob was played by Howard Jones, Sue by Amanda Watkins, Annie by Jane Jones, and Bill by Gordon Stewart. Production was by Dave Baldwin.